Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guest today is novelist and playwright John Biguenet, whose new work, Broomstick, will have a staged reading at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. And if you want to jumpstart any writing projects, you'll want to hear from my second guest, Dr. Richard Luth, who'll be directing the New Orleans Writing Marathon during the festival. John Biguenet is the Robert Hunter Distinguished University Professor at Loyola University and the author of 7 books, including the story collection, The Torturer's Apprentice, and the novel Oyster, one of my favorites. In recent years, he's turned his attention to the stage, writing such award-winning plays as The Vulgar Soul, Rising Water, Shotgun, and Night Train. I'm excited to talk with him today about his new work, Broomstick, which debuts at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival in a stage reading. Hi, John.
Hello, Susan.
So glad to see you.
You too.
Thank you for letting me read this new work. Your theatergoers and followers in New Orleans know you so much for those wonderful post-Katrina plays, but Broomstick feels very different.
I was very anxious to write about something other than Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also interested in trying to find something funny to talk about. Because when I began this, there were still so many problems to face here in New Orleans that I needed a distraction. And it came in the form of an invitation from Christine McMurtle Wallace, an actor who had been in 2 of my previous plays, to write a play for her, and particularly a play that she could tour with. And so it was going to be a very simple one-person show. And as I thought about it, I thought it might be fun to explore the life story of a witch. But because a one-person show requires a great deal of memory, I thought I could make it a little bit easier for Christine if I put the entire thing in blank verse, in iambic pentameter. But because it's about a witch, and a lot of it bears on childhood, I thought, well, rhyme might be appropriate too. So I wound up writing the entire play in iambic pentameter and rhymed couplets.
60 pages almost of poetry.
After a while, everything comes out as heroic couplets. shopping lists, little notes to my wife, everything was rhyming for a while.
I tell her to keep those notes. When I first knew you, I thought of you as a poet.
My degree's in poetry,
yeah.
And my great love is poetry, actually.
So that must have been really natural for you to start.
To go back to poetry, what happened is, for me as an American poet, I found that the lyric meant that I was always talking about myself. And I got to a certain point in my life where I couldn't imagine a less interesting subject than me. And fiction allowed me to enter the lives of other people, and very different kinds of people. And the stage does the same thing. The great advantage of the stage, though, is instead of being locked up in a room for a year to write a novel, you get to associate with other people. And they always serve food at rehearsals. So for a novelist, the theater is paradise.
So tell us about your co-conspirators in this work.
This was a very lonely work. In terms of composition, I was working away, and really the only person involved with production who kept looking at it was Christine. She was doing a number of other projects. She just finished a run at Swine Palace in Baton Rouge of Pride and Prejudice. So I would send her groups of pages at a time, and her response was very helpful. The most important thing that's happened in this development, though, was a staged reading at Stages Repertory in Houston last May. And at that point, I had a much larger version of the play, 2 acts with an intermission. And we had a terrific response to it. But in the talk back, it began to be clear to me that I needed some structural changes. And so we now have a shorter, sleeker Broomstick.
Ah. And George Judy is the director, right, for this?
Yes, he's the artistic director at Swine Palace and is very interested in developing a new play program at Swine Palace. So he's just been a wonder to work with. I was in Baton Rouge a few weeks ago for rehearsal on this. And he's both a dramaturge and a director, so he's looking at the script very intensively, even as we're thinking about how to perform it.
So what does he bring to this process? How does this work for you?
Well, in this case, a cold eye. Since he hadn't seen all the stages moving up to the version that we'll perform at Tennessee Williams, he was able to be a kind of cold reader who could respond to this particular version without having seen preliminary versions of it. So his commentary was enormously useful. The important thing he said was, we got a show. And once I heard that, I knew it was going to be small modifications rather than wholesale rewriting.
Oh, that's reassuring.
Yes, especially after working on this for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. You seem to really enjoy the collaboration of theater.
If you don't, there's no room for you on the stage. Unlike the novel, where you're really controlling every detail of the story you're telling, you have to trust the artistry of the other professionals you're working with in the theater. And as always the case with human beings, if you trust other people, you'll get farther along than if you try to do it by yourself.
But what does this mean for your fiction writing?
Oh, I'm writing like crazy right now.
I'm
working on a novel about what happened here after the flood. It covers the first year after the flood. It's about a young couple. A number of short stories I've finished in the last year. One of them, in fact, that I just concluded is about a lawyer from New Orleans who's in Rome and passes the tailor shop where the Pope has all of his garments fabricated. And he thinks it would make a great Mardi Gras costume and buys an entire set of regalia, papal regalia. But when it arrives, he starts wearing it every night and having drinks and listening to madrigals. And the part that I finally concluded was when he writes his first encyclical and distributes it in the French Quarter.
I actually have a friend who collects religious outfits. So that's not so far-fetched, you know.
But what I'm finding in the fiction, I just finished another story called Sand about a city in a desert that's buried by a sand dune. Even if I write in the desert, I'm still talking about New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah. It's a hard city to abandon, and at the moment, it's a hard city to escape.
Right. And you'll be premiering this play in the staged reading at the Tennessee Williams Festival, and I know you've been to the festival before. What about that event makes it special for you?
Well, it's bringing the play home. To see a New Orleans audience react to what I've written is going to tell me a lot about the script, about what's working and what's not working. But the kind of people who go to Tennessee Williams year after year are such lovers of literature and storytelling that it's a very expert audience that I'll have laughing as the play develops.
And I went to your masterclass with M.A. Hayes that year, and you were fantastic. That was really wonderful, a wonderful lesson for any writer.
Particularly for a fiction writer, you so rarely encounter your reader that theater is an extraordinary kind of experience because there's an immediate response to the words that you've written. And teaching, of course, is like that too. So there's a way in which you become a student in a stage reading at a festival like Tennessee Williams. You learn what you've said.
Mm-hmm. So stage a little bit of your own reading for us right now. Read us a bit of Broomstick.
Now, one of the things about The Witch and sort of the idea behind the entire play is that someone has returned as an adult years after having spent time with her in her little cottage. Of course, that person is not on stage. There's an empty chair that she's addressing throughout the play. And she keeps trying to get this returnee to eat her black bone stew and to play the games that she remembers, such as the game Nine Fingers, as she calls it. But this visitor is a little hesitant to engage in those pastimes, and so she tries to convince him in the following way. "No, no, my dear, don't be alarmed. It's just a little game. You won't be harmed. And even if you are, I know some tricks to reattach a severed finger, fix a foot that's lost a toe or two or three. I'm teasing you. But after all, ask me, who really needs 10 fingers, all those toes? If we were talking, oh, let's say a nose. Now, you lose that. Okay, I'd understand if you thought things had gotten out of hand. It's not like we got extra ones to spare the way we do with eyes and ears. A pair of anything, you can afford to lose the first when there's a second still to use. A nose, though, there's not much to take its place, at least not sitting there in the middle of your face. So, yeah, I might be slow to sympathize with someone lost just one of his two eyes. It comes to noses, though, there ain't no just. You lose your nose and make a little fuss. Well, that's to be expected, I suppose, seeing you lost your one and only nose. But these shenanigans about a toe or two, you still got 8, 9 others, though. So what you say we play our little game, and let's not worry who we're going to blame things go wrong and don't turn out so good. Mean the world to me. It really would."
I didn't know you had it in you, John. That was quite wonderful.
Yeah, in the script I call for an Appalachian accent or at least a country accent. And that's helped me both in terms of hearing the voice of the witch as I've been writing this, but also in terms of the kinds of idioms that I can use. I would think that she has to be someone who lives apart. And so living up on a mountaintop, having learned the lessons of the woods, is something very useful to a witch.
Oh, I can't wait to see it. Thank you so much for being here, John.
It's been a pleasure, Susan.
The stage reading of Broomstick takes place Saturday, March 24th at 6 p.m., followed by a talkback at the Hotel Monteleone during the 26th Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. John will also take part in a panel discussion with playwrights John Guare, Jewel Gomez, and Martin Sherman, Sunday, March 25th at 11:30 a.m., also at the Hotel Monteleone. For more information and tickets, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. John will also be appearing at the opening of the new Lakeview branch of the New Orleans Public Library, March 22nd at 1 o'clock. Thanks again.
Thanks, Susan.
Richard Luth is a professor of English at Southeastern Louisiana University, where he teaches courses in living writers, Louisiana literature, and creative writing. He's also the founding director of the Southeastern Louisiana Writing Project, and he's created the New Orleans Writing Marathon, which he'll be conducting at this year's Tennessee Williams Festival. He also edited the book, The Writing Marathon, in Good Company Revealed. Welcome to The Reading Life, Richard.
Thank you, Susan.
So glad to have you here. Now, this writing marathon is something new to the Tennessee Williams Festival this year. Tell us a little bit about what it is and how it works.
The writing marathon is a journey of writers across a city or any other landscape. It's something that we started here in New Orleans back in around 1994 with writing teachers. And essentially, it's a chance for writers to get together in groups and go out across New Orleans in small groups and essentially eat, drink, and write together for whatever quantity of time the marathon lasts. And it could be from an hour to, in some cases, I've done it for 3 days.
3 days? Yes. Oh my gosh. And you've done groups of varying sizes as well, haven't you?
Correct. The group of the whole community of writers can be anything as small as one or two or three people to as large as something like 200 people. And usually in New Orleans, when I've done it with teachers who are writers, it's been a group of about 30 to 35 people. And that group will then separate into small groups of three or four or five. And those groups are just whatever kind of little groups form by themselves to write.
Ah, so they're self-selected.
Correct.
And when you do this in various cities, do they generally stay in one area of the city or spread out? Or
no,
how does that work?
That's interesting. It depends. In something like New Orleans, they primarily stay in the French Quarter, but last year when we did it, one group went on the streetcar and went out, up towards St. Charles Magazine. They wrote while they were on the streetcar, so the writing takes place at virtually all times.
Now, is there anything you feel is especially conducive to writing in the French Quarter?
Well, the French Quarter is a beautiful place to write for a lot of reasons. One reason, I think, is that people really respect writers here. Mm-hmm. And so you'll be sitting in a bar writing and someone will say, "What are you doing?" And you say, "I'm writing," and they'll come up and offer a story or a free beer or a free cup of coffee. I think there's a lot of respect in the French Quarter, just by its very nature, for writers and other kinds of artists. But also it's full of coffee houses, full of pubs, wonderful open spaces, Jackson Square. So I think the French Quarter is a place where writers will be so fascinated by what they see that it doesn't even mean having to go into a spot. Some of them will write on curbstones. So yeah, the French Quarter is just a fantastic place.
But you always think of writing as such a lonely, solitary thing. What is it that the Writing Marathon does for writers?
The Writing Marathon, by putting people together in a large group, first of all, 30 to 200 people, forms kind of a community. And you can feel that when you're on one side of the French Quarter, you know that there's somebody on the other side writing at the same time about whatever matters to him or her. So you feel part of this larger community. But also that smaller group you're with, what happens is you become very intimate with them while you're writing over the course of a day. I've seen complete strangers become very, very close friends by the end of a day, because as you're writing, there might be four or five rounds of writing that go on over the course of a day. And each time you're writing, you're almost subconsciously responding to what other people have written and read to you. And so these very tight bonds form. And I think that's one of the best reasons for having these small groups.
Sort of like meditating in a class or something, you know?
Yeah.
That all shared intention,
yes.
I think is
yeah.
what it is. Yeah. And what do you do during all this?
Oh,
are you writing too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the things I often tell the writers is once we start, if you wish, come on back and we'll have a spot that we might gather to read. But I say, if you're on a roll, don't come back. Let's write. It's all about the writing.
Mm-hmm. But you have set aside a time for people to gather
yes.
and read their work.
Mm-hmm.
And you have some special ideas about how people should respond to one another.
Yes. Within the process, during the course of the day, as they're writing in small groups, they respond simply by saying thank you. And that's to do away with any form of criticism. And I think that makes it very, very helpful for writers who might be intimidated about reading their work. Because when you're writing spontaneously in strange locations, you really don't know what you're going to write. And sometimes it can be very, very deep, something very personal. And what I find is that having the small group and just having your respondents say thank you makes it much easier for people to feel comfortable. At the end of the day, it depends, but often we'll meet back at a pub or a hotel room if it's a conference. And then when people read, they're asked if they'd like to volunteer to read, and then we applaud. It's a different kind of thing. So there's the lack of criticism that I think makes the whole process so successful.
Well, guaranteed applause, I think, would be very helpful, too.
Yeah.
Is there any way a person can prepare for this? If someone were feeling hopeful but kind of shy about taking part in the writing marathon, what would you tell them?
I tell them not to worry about it. That might not help. But the only real preparation you need, a good pair of shoes, a pen or pencil, and a journal.
Are there any rules for this marathon?
Yeah, there are. One of the rules is that it's all about writing. So while it's good to do some sightseeing as you're walking along and to go into strange places, that's all part of it. Ultimately, it needs to come back to the writing. A second rule really is when you do sit with your group, you should allow adequate time to write, 10 or 15 minutes minimum, and then you all read to each other. And it's voluntary. If you don't feel like reading, you don't have to. At the end of the reading, you simply say thank you, and then you get something to eat, you socialize, and that whole side of it is very important, too, because it's sort of a blend of, you know, you're writing, you're reading, and you're socializing. They all blend together, and you move on to another place and do it again and again and again for as much time as you have.
So will you drop in on different locations throughout the day or just...
Well, every group will go to several locations usually. I myself will always be with a writing group and I'll end up at, you know, three or four different locations.
So will you follow them or will they follow you?
Oh, nobody follows me, no. In fact, one of the first writing marathons I did, I was apprehensive because I had about 35 people. It was in Baltimore. I said, here's how we'll do it, okay. And I walked out the door and I remember feeling 70 footsteps behind me. Because they were all following me, and I thought, oh my gosh, if they all follow me, this won't work, because where will we go where we can all write? And little by little, people broke off. So a small group broke off to the Barnes & Noble, another group broke off to some chairs. You know, in 10 minutes, I turned around, and there was no one behind me, and I had two or three friends, and that was it. So I think we work on the faith that people will find their place, and that's what makes it good, too.
Well, you can meet up with Richard Luth at 9 a.m. Saturday, March 24th or Sunday, March 25th in the Queen Anne Ballroom at the Monteleone for the Writing Marathon at the Tennessee Williams Festival. And you can email him for further information at rluth, that's L-O-U-T-H, at selu.edu or email info@tennesseewilliams.net. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm looking forward to seeing you around the quarter that weekend.
I am too.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. John Klingman signs New in New Orleans Architecture, Tuesday, March 20th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center, and again Thursday, March 29th at 5:30 p.m. at the Garden District Bookshop. Alex Cook signs Louisiana Saturday Night, looking for a good time in South Louisiana's juke joints, honky tonks, and dance halls. Thursday, March 22nd at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Bayou St. John. The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation presents the 4th Annual Tom Dent Congo Square Symposium, Saturday, March 24th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Joy Theater, 1200 Canal Street. Two of the world's top experts on African and African-American culture, Yale University University Professor Robert Ferris Thompson and former National Endowment for the Humanities Chairman William Ferris will discuss Between Heaven and Earth, soothing the troubled soul with arts of our ancestors. Exploring art is a healing force. For more information, check out congosquaretalks.com. Kit Wall signs New Orleans Classic Brunches Saturday, March 24th from 3 to 5 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Elaine Anderson and Emmanuel David and a number of the contributors to a new collection of essays, The Women of Katrina, How Gender, Race, and Class Matter in an American Disaster. Sign books Saturday, March 24th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Corey McLaughlin signs The Butterfly and the Typewriter. Today's guest, Corey McLaughlin, signs The Butterfly and the Typewriter, The Short Tragic Life of John Kennedy Toole, and The Remarkable Story of a Confederacy of Dunces, March 26th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop, and again Tuesday, March 27th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Noted fiction writer Antonia Nelson is the 27th Zale Kimmerling Writer-in-Residence at Newcomb, March 26th through 29th. She'll present a reading from her work and sit for an interview with Professor Thomas Beller, Monday, March 26th at 7 p.m. in the Kendall Cram Room of the Lavin-Burnick Center. Authors and close friends Amy Dickinson, author of Mighty Queens of Freeville, and Brian Batt, author of Big Easy Style, signed their books Tuesday, March 27th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple. Watch for the openings of these New Orleans Public Library branches. The Norman Mayer branch opens Tuesday, March 20th at 2 p.m. and remains open till 8 that evening. The Smith Lakeview branch opens Thursday, March 22nd at 11:30 a.m. and remains open until 8 that evening. The New Orleans East Regional Library opens Thursday, April 12th at 2 p.m. and will stay open until 8 that evening. One of my favorite times of year is upon us. It's time for the 26th Annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. It's March 21st through 25th at the Hotel Monteleon and other locations throughout the French Quarter. Whether your taste runs to seeing stars like Piper Laurie, whose wonderful new memoir is Learning to Live Out Loud, or classic dramatic performances like Southern Rep Streetcar Named Desire, or hearing a panel of NPR voices, like those of Eve Abrams, Amy Dickinson, Fred Kasten, Nick Spitzer, Gwen Tompkins, or meeting biographers and novelists and music writers and memoirists, there's something for everyone. For a complete schedule, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. And the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold their semi-annual Big Book Sale, March 29th through April 1st at the Pontchartrain Center on Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, that's March 29th through 31st, from 10 a.m. to 8, and Sunday, April 1st from noon to 5. All proceeds benefit the Jefferson Parish Libraries. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org or email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.